Talk Shoe.
Recorded live.
Hello, this is William Fink for Eli James, and this is Yahweh's Covenant People. Eli will be off tonight. It is Saturday, May 15th already. The year just started, and it's almost half over. And tonight I have Clifton Emmaheiser here, and we're going to talk about his recent work, Identifying the Beast of the Field. And he's already written parts 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and I think he's working on 6. How you doing, Clifton?
Oh, pretty good.
Praise Yahweh. It's good to have you here. In Christian identity, we've gone through several concepts of the Genesis 1 creation. And first, I think, the earlier identists started off believing, and Swift and Comparé, I know, upheld this position, that the Adam created, or the man, as the King James has it, right, created in Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 through 28, that man was somehow a different man than Genesis chapter 2, and that first man represented the non-white races. And an examination of the Hebrew, that entire concept just crumbles. It just falls apart. It's not a plausible concept at all. Well, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, when you understand the proper meanings of the beast of the field at Genesis 1:24, the word she doesn't support the other races. It has absolutely nothing to do with it.
That's the next step. Once they realize that the Adam in Genesis 1:26 through 28 is the white race Adam. And the same creation is the one described a different manner in Genesis chapter 2. Then they try to find the creation of the other races in Genesis 1:24.
Well, they try to find a place for them, and there isn't any place for them.
Well, precisely. That's what I would think.
Once you understand the true meanings of Genesis 1:24, it destroys the sixth and eighth day creation theory.
Well, right. The sixth and eighth day creation theory absolutely should be destroyed, because Yahweh rested on a seventh day, and there's no eighth day ever mentioned in the Bible.
Right.
He rested from all of his works, which to me means that he rested from the creation of new species. That was it. Everything that he created was done by the seventh day.
Study on the word che, and you put it on my website, and I would recommend anybody, because I went clear through the Old Testament, and I identified every place in the Old Testament che is used, and how it's translated in each case, and there's no place in the entire Old Testament that supports che as being the creation of the other races. And I put a lot of material on that. I went to Esord and I took all those verses and I copied and pasted them over to that document. Every time the word Shea was used, I went to Brown Drivers Briggs, and Brown Drivers Briggs breaks down the word Shea into four word groups.
Okay, can you explain those?
Well, they're just slightly different from each other. You almost have to know, and some of your other lexicons also break it down into four groups, and not quite as exactly the way that Brown Drivers Briggs does it, but you have to know which one of those word groups that you fall in. You just can't go pick a word out of Strong's and say, here's the other races. There's more to it than that.
Well, exactly, because a living thing, and it's often used to describe beasts, four-legged beasts, and it's often used to describe Adamites, but it's never used to describe other races.
Well, the other races are not, the word Che doesn't fit them in the first place, because they're dead. They don't have the spirit of Adam. And so che is the wrong word. If you want to find the word che, it's che God, you know, living God. And the Almighty breathed into Adam the breath of life. Well, it's che life, and it become a living soul, a che soul. And not soul with no such thing is applied to the other races. In fact, they're dead all the way.
And I think that's what Christ is saying when he says, and this is several times in the Old Testament and the New, when he says that Yahweh is the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob, and that he's the God of the living and not the God of the dead.
That's exactly right. He's the God of the living, and Abraham and Isaac and those Adamites, they were living.
Eve is the mother of all living because she's the matriarch of our race.
Well, that probably is the word che, too. And so you have to go get the che people to know who they are.
Absolutely. Right. The other races simply don't fit into that creation, into that equation, because they are not mentioned in that manner anywhere in the Bible.
I would like to say also that when I got into Sioux Seed Line, the one thing that helped me out was to understand the idioms of the Bible. Now, the only guy that I can find that ever did a fairly lengthy work on it, and of course I know that he's probably wrong on a lot of things he promoted, but nevertheless, on the idioms, he did quite well, and that's George M. Lamsa. Now, I don't think he's one of us.
I'm sure he's not, to be honest with you, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, but anyway, he's got a book of idioms in the Bible explained, and he's got another little bit bigger book, idioms in the Bible explained, and a key to the original Gospels. Now, I haven't ever read that key to the original Gospels, but I was thinking about going and trying, find all the other idioms which he didn't address, because I'm sure there's more to it, but I just don't know quite how to go about that. But we have to see, the tree is not a physical, there's actually a wooden tree, and then there's it's like in the New Testament there, where Christ healed a blind man, and after a while, I think he kind of led him outside the city gate and asked him what he saw, and he said, "I see men as trees walking." He saw trees walking around.
Well, right, and I think that was probably used to indicate the use of the metaphor to us.
Yeah,
as if we were a totally hard-headed people and would never get it otherwise, and you point that scripture out to them and they still don't get it.
But he saw men as trees walking. Now, think about it. When was the last time that down the street a couple blocks, some oak tree pulled up its roots and started walking down the street?
And they still don't get the use of that idiom. Well, George Lamsa, he may have done well, and I would admit that in a couple of places he did, with explaining certain Hebrew and Aramaic idioms. However, he takes a serious wrong turn when he tries to assert that the original language of New Testament scripture was Aramaic.
Yeah, right. And I bought that story at one time, but I don't hold to that anymore.
Well, I should probably do a program just on that one night. The original story of the New Testament, the original language was certainly Greek. It was never Aramaic.
Yeah. And I don't doubt that maybe somewhere along the line, because, Josephus wrote in Aramaic to the northern barbarians, which were Israelites, and evidently they understood Aramaic, and that was the way he could communicate with them. So I wouldn't doubt along the line, maybe there's some Aramaic manuscripts of some kind. They probably have all been destroyed. Nobody probably has any, but I can see where they might have. But I would prefer to think that they were, if that's the case, that they were translated from the Greek over into the Aramaic form.
Well, everything that I have, And this is the best Greek Greek language scholarship, New Testament period scholarship also. And everything that I have tells me that the Aramaic manuscripts of the New Testament were translated into Aramaic from Greek in the 4th century.
I can believe that.
And we know of no Aramaic manuscripts of the New Testament that are complete that predate the 4th century. And that actually is what's explained in the pages of the NA-27 as well, which actually cites all of the differences in the Aramaic languages as it does in the Greek. It just doesn't have the Aramaic text, but it tells you what the Aramaic texts, which readings of which Greek manuscripts they support. So they're very well informed on the Aramaic manuscripts.
Well, I'd recommend that anybody get a copy of Lamps's Idioms in the Bible Explained. Let his other stuff go, but he does pretty good on that. And see, the idioms are the foundation for a two-seed line, and the idioms are the basis for the beast of the field. And I went clear through Esord on 929, which is Behemoth, which most of these, so evidently Behemoth, is real, quadruped animals, but as an idiom, they're bipod creatures, and I went clear through the Old Testament, and I could only find 10 passages where the context is the beast as a bipod creature. I only found 10 passages.
Well, what you're trying to say is that there's 10 passages where beast is used as an idiom for an anthropoid, for a person of a human race or however I have to.
Yeah, well, really, the only way you can take it is people of the other races.
Right.
And so the biggest share of the time it's used for cattle and wild animals and that type of thing. But
it is an idiom for the other races, and it's understandable since it's evident from apocryphal scripture that the other races have some of that in them. That's their origination. Their origination is in the species of the crossbreeding of species or the mixing of species by the fallen angels, as is explained in the same parts of the Book of Enoch that Jude and Peter quote from.
Yeah, the thing that bothers me on it, though, is that Strong and Gesenius and Brown Drivers Briggs, in their definitions, now Strong's gives various places. He shows an X if it's an idiom, but on 929 he doesn't. So evidently that's an idiom that Strong and the other Bible scholars have missed. But the context tells us it has to be an idiom. So sometimes we got to use our common sense on context.
Well, absolutely. And one of the best places, the 10 passages that you cite, the most famous is probably the one in Jonah 3:7, is it? Where it talks about man and beast having
Jonah 3:7-8.
Right, and the the clearest one to me, and I quoted it last night in the Christogenos program with Eli, is the Leviticus 18:23 passage.
Now, Bible Works did I added just the part I wanted, and they said in part of living creatures other than man as inferior to man. Now that's pretty good. Israelites, rather, I wouldn't put the word. Now, they say other living, creatures. I would say other I'd say parasites rather than a living creature, because look at how they want the food stamps and all these freebies, and they're willing to start a riot if they can't get them.
Well, I would I'm going to talk. Let's talk about Alan Campbell's.
Oh yeah, Alan Campbell.
But let me, on the New Ensign site, I have a sermon. The video is posted of Alan Campbell. I'll paste the link into the chat. That the video, Alan Campbell's "Who Is the Beast of the Field" video, and his conclusions are sound, but the way he reaches the conclusions is all wrong, because he's taking that word "che" and claiming that the word "beast" comes from that word "che." And that would lead a lot of people in identity astray right there.
Well, actually, he doesn't use the word che. It's chivia he uses.
Well, it's a related word.
It's Chaldee. It's
right. It's a
Chaldee word. It's not. It's only found in Daniel.
Right, and he claims that that's the word for beast, where these in these ten passages, where it's really behemoth, right?
Yeah,
or
right.
Behema.
And see, that's what got me started on this in the first place. A friend of mine gave me a copy of his video on that, and I watched it, and I liked it pretty well, what he was saying. And I thought, well, I'm going to go through and make notes on it. And I started through it on making notes, and every time he cited the scripture, that it wasn't the Hebrew words he said it was. And so I put the project aside. And I, put it on the back burner, and probably for 2 or 3 years, and I'm just now getting around to addressing it.
Well, why would he make that mistake? What did he just not check? That sounds.
I can't figure that out. I don't think there's any lexicon or anything that he was using. He must have heard somebody else say it, and he was just repeating somebody else. Either that, or he doesn't know how to research his stuff.
Well, I'll say one thing. That's most of the mistakes I've made the last 10 years in writing and assessing the Bible, I'm not beating my own chest, but many of them were caused by following others and not checking up on them.
Uh-huh.
Taking Swift for granted, taking Comparate for granted. We all make mistakes.
Well, I was doing the same thing with Swift.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was doing the same thing with Swift and Comparate. It's only been in the last 7 or 8 years that I've been becoming critical of Comparate.
Right, we have to be. We all make mistakes, but we have to check up on each other.
I still appreciate them very, very much.
Well, of course.
But I'm more critical with them than I used to be.
Right. And I would never want people to take what I'm writing just for granted. I would want them to check it out.
That's the way I do, too. Don't take anything that I've written. I mean, if I've written it, you check on it and on yourself to make sure that what I did was right. Because I got erasers on my pencils, too.
Well, right. Absolutely. But Campbell, he listed all these. He discusses most of the 10 places that you have pointed out where the word beast is used as a metaphor for an anthropoid, a biped, a hominid is probably the best word, a hominid. And it's very clear to me, especially in Deuteronomy and in the book of Jonah, that word's being used as a hominid. I'm sorry, Leviticus. Let me read that passage in Leviticus from the King James. Neither shalt thou lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. It is confusion. That can't be talking about a four-legged beast, because a woman lying with a four-legged beast would not cause confusion.
Right.
I mean, even if there was offspring, it would be easily identifiable as a the progeny of something alien.
I don't think that there's ever been a case where between a man and animal that there's ever been a pregnancy from bestiality. But the angels have a little bit different system than what we, I mean, if you was to see an angel, they'd look just like a white man. But they have powers a little beyond us because they can change themselves into, they can make themselves appear, you know, it's like in Josephus, an angel appeared as an owl. Now the same passage in Acts speaks of when this Edomite saw this angel as it's recorded in Acts, and he knew he was going to die. Well, Josephus has all. Well, if you stop and think about it, if an angel has the power to appear as an owl, he's only one step away from procreating with that owl.
Well, I don't, you know, I'm pragmatic, and it doesn't matter to me how you want to interpret the Book of Enoch, where it says that the angels mingled their seed with the seed of every beast. Yeah, you know, either they did it sexually or they did it scientifically. It doesn't matter to me how.
Well, they could have done it in a test tube, you know.
It's clear that they did it to me, and the book says it, and James and Peter and Jude and Paul all, and it can be well demonstrated that they all accepted that as scripture.
And you know that those scriptures were scoffed at back in the 1800s, and when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls and found all the books of the Book of Giants and the Book of Enoch, they don't have anything to scoff at anymore.
I noticed that one Bible study book that you cited in Identifying the Beast of the Field Part 4, which will be on your website, I hope one soon, maybe next week, that they had the audacity, the commentators in that book, to claim that the book was spurious, even though they admitted that Peter and Jude were quoting from it. And they had the audacity to take the position that Peter and Jude were quoting from a spurious book.
Yeah, that's terrible, isn't it?
That's blasphemous.
Yeah.
That's terrible. That's.
And I have that book in my house, you know, Smith's, I think Smith's Dictionary of the Bible. And
that would be a position to me that only a Jew could take. The Bible deniers, the New Testament scripture deniers. I mean, Jude and Peter are clearly...
Well, see, that was back in the 1800s when they wrote that book, when they had all those... what'd they call that over in Europe? The critical... some kind of criticism, I forget what...
Textual criticism.
Textual criticism, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The schools of the higher critics in 19th century Germany. Most of those higher critics were Jews.
So I'm glad that the Dead Sea Scrolls come along, even though a lot of it is nothing more than fragments. It does prove that these books existed, and that Jude and Peter and whoever else quoted from it, they had every right to quote from it.
Absolutely. And Paul accepted those as scriptural. He makes many allusions to the things that Enoch said and paraphrases. And I'm sure that Christ himself did. And there is actually, in the NA-27, it lists over 50 passages that are allusions or paraphrases from one Enoch.
Uh-huh.
In one of the appendices.
Well, that can hardly be a spurious book, then. Now, it could be embellished, you know.
Well, I'm sure it was, because one Enoch, what we know is one Enoch is actually probably four or five books that were put together, and not all of them were found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. That there was one section that was not found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. Not that the Dead Sea Scrolls are known to be complete, However, that's always an indication that, it's possible. If no fragment at all was found, it's an indication it's possible that they may not have accepted it, but they may just not have had it, or perhaps it didn't survive. I'm not. However, 80% of what we know is the books that became One Enoch were among the Dead Sea Scrolls in a fairly complete version. That leads me to mention John Strugnell. You had written once the Two Seed Line and the Dead Sea Scrolls, and John Strugnell had complained that, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls were shut off to the public and to most scholars in 1968, right?
Yeah.
And they were made accessible again in 1993. And one of the few people that saw both sides of that gap was John Strugnell, who was a Catholic priest and a professor at Harvard. And he complained that there were books of Enoch in Aramaic that were missing, and they branded him as being an anti-Semite for that complaint. Well, what do you mean they're missing? What are you, an anti-Semite? Well, that's an aside. However, this I think it was part one of this identifying the beast of the field talked about chimeras. And it talked about mixed species and how donkeys and horses mate and lions and tigers. But there's scientific evidence, and in part four you go into it. There's scientific evidence that perhaps certain types of apes and monkeys and humans can mate, or anthropods can mate and mate successfully. And that this evidence is pretty much suppressed in the mainstream media. They don't like to pay too much attention of it. You want to talk about any of that? I know you were talking about Basu, the man ape hybrid, was one of them. And that there was a monkey boy in Kazakhstan, and that this has happened many times, and protruding tailbones on Japanese prisoners of war in World War II. Do you remember writing about that?
Yeah, I wrote about that.
I thought you might want to elaborate on any of that.
I'm going to go here to a certain place in the document if I can go to it here.
Yeah, it's towards the end of part four.
Oh. My find is going to act up here. I talked about Oliver first, you know, and you probably weren't familiar with the Oliver story, were you?
Well, you had sent me a link a few months ago that I had checked out, and that was the first time I heard of it.
Yeah, uh-huh. And then I got the Basu story.
And Oliver was a chimpanzee, half human and half ape.
And then there was the monkey child over in Kazakhstan. Which one did you want me to find? The
Well, I just wanted to mention them as an inference that this is a possibility. That you know, a lot of people claim that science defines a species as being any two organisms that can breed together, basically, and the offspring have fertile offspring, and that's how science defines a species. But I don't think that's a proper definition of a species. In many cases, and there's clear evidence that many species can interbreed and mix successfully.
Well,
I didn't know. I
was. I forgot what you wanted me to look up. No.
No, I didn't. I want to know about your experience with these Japanese soldiers with tailbone.
Oh yeah. Okay. Okay. I found the one on Oliver. You know, they took Oliver to Japan. It says the trip to Japan was turning to the point for Oliver just because even though his owner was told it was going to be for scientific purposes, it was clear that the Japanese media wanted to portray Oliver for entertainment. And you know, one of those Japanese girls even wanted to sleep with Oliver.
And she wouldn't be ashamed. That was on Japanese television, and she wouldn't have been ashamed of that at all.
Right.
That's why they can't blush, that they have no shame.
But here I found another Japanese. The media attention didn't stop there. As a Japanese actress, said that she would sleep with Oliver, and this even would be televised. She was even willing to have it televised on television while she was sleeping with it.
And that was a long time ago. That was before American culture really polluted Japan, I would think. I mean, that was...
I think that was back around 2002, something
like
that.
Oh, was it that recent? Okay, I thought it was...
Maybe it was longer ago than that. Okay, there's another Japanese thing. Okay, now then. I can't find the one that you're talking about there.
Well, that's quite all right. I mean, we could go back to Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis 1:24, and I'm going to read from your Identifying the Beasts of the Field part 2. And you quote Genesis, the Septuagint, Genesis 1:24 through 25. Then God said, "Let the earth produce animal life according to kind, four-footed beasts and reptiles and wild beasts of the earth according to kind." Now, in two of those places, the word che appears. Am I mistaken?
Yeah, in living creature is che creature.
And
wild beast. And it's kind of like saying lively beast. You know, a wild beast is pretty lively, right?
Right. Well, right. It's
it's more lively than a cow in a stall someplace.
Right, but it's more or less a choice of the translators, I believe, the English translators, to translate it in that manner.
Well, I'll tell you what, they use that word che, and che even is raw meat, is che meat. And I guess, you know, it's closer to like it was, you know, it's like somebody... got injured and you can see the muscles and the bones, you know, well, the raw meat's hanging out, but if it's raw meat that isn't cooked yet, it's still che meat. So there's a lot of what would you call it?
There's a lot of latitude
to the word.
But there's absolutely no indication, because it's not used anywhere, that word is used of a hominid of a different race.
No, there's no support. If somebody can find it, let me know, but I couldn't find it.
Well, right. So my point is that the claim that the che of Genesis 1:24 represents non-Adamic hominids of the other races is simply an unsubstantiated and unsupportable claim.
Right.
You're reading something in the scripture that may not be there.
There's two ches there. One is saying living creatures. Now, there's three of them. There's living creatures, and so it's saying che creatures, and then it names the creatures, you know, domesticated cattle and creeping, you know, snakes and that type of creature, and wild beast.
And your papers go on to demonstrate how those words are used later in many passages.
Yeah, I went into detail, you know, time after time after time, and from different versions of the Bible. And see, the Septuagint, Charles does pretty good on that.
On the Greek in his translation.
Yeah, it appears that he did pretty good on that because it's very understandable. I'd like to, you know, it'd be nice if you had the Greek manuscripts that he translated from.
Well, I probably do. In the, you know, I'm sure he had to use the Vaticanus manuscript or the Alexandrinus manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which one he used, but
there's two of them on that, is there?
I have Brenton's. Yeah, you know, I have Brenton's. The Septuagint he used is the Vaticanus manuscript, and I've been slowly posting that to Christogenia. Yeah, you know, I just started a few weeks ago, and I think I have.
Well, you're posting the English version of it.
Well, no, I'm posting the Greek of the Septuagint to Christogenia.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I'm doing that with the hope that, and I'm not making any promises here, that someday I'm going to be able to translate at least parts of it. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a major undertaking translating the Septuagint. I would love to translate the Septuagint. I don't know if Yahweh is going to afford me the time, and you know that. But it is my intention to translate at least large parts of it. I would like to translate several of the apocryphal books. I would like to translate the wisdom books. I would like to translate the Psalms, and that's where I'll probably start, or in those places.
Well, you know, there's a lot of good things about the Septuagint. I appreciate. Having both, you know, I have the Breton electronically, and I have the Charles, the book, you know, and it's nice to have both of them, you know, check back and forth to see the two translators and see if there's some variations there. But, you know, even the Septuagint as at best, it had to come off of the Masoretic text someplace, and they can't help but have lost something from the translation from the Hebrew to the Greek.
Well, of course, and in a lot of places it's lost quite a bit from the Hebrew to the Greek, and there's meanings of words. I mean, the problem translating Hebrew to Greek is the same problem as translating Hebrew to English. I mean, the Hebrews had three words for man, three key words anyway, and we have one that we commonly use.
It would be interesting to go to the Greek and see what they have for living creature.
The Hebrew has five or six words for stranger that are commonly used, and the Greek has two that are commonly used.
So there's a lot lost right there.
Oh, yes.
And if you can't separate from nakri, from some of the other forms of stranger there, you know, you aren't going to know what kind of stranger you're talking about.
Right. And that word stranger in the New Testament, that the one word only appears once that signifies somebody of another race. And that appears in Luke, who's actually a Greek, right? So he wasn't talking about the difference between Greeks and Hebrews, I don't think. Well, the other word is xenos. And a xenos is not a racial alien. A xenos is a stranger who has, in Greek, certain rights of hospitality and decency and treatment that he expects when he's in your country. In other words, a xenos in the New Testament context can only be somebody of another Adamic nation that's on peaceful terms with yours. That's all it could mean. And it's even translated by, one example is William Kovacs is the translator, the latest translator of the Loeb Library edition of Euripides' plays. And he translated them in the late 1990s. And he takes the word xenos and translates it guest friend, not stranger. And there's a huge difference. And he is correct. So there's a lot lost from Hebrew to Greek, but an examination of the Greek in the Septuagint or in Josephus also allows us to determine how those men understood the Hebrew. And they're not perfect by any means, but they're a lot closer to the Hebrew language than we are today. And it's hard to, you know, if we dispute with them, we have to make sure that we're standing on solid ground.
I found that place that you wanted on the Japanese there. That was, I was copying what I put in Watchman Teaching Letter 63. And what, WTL number 63, I added the following comment. I had heard stories that some of the Japanese prisoners captured during World War II actually had spurs for tails. And of course, then when I saw this Wonder Boy on television, I thought about that right away, you know.
Well, would American soldiers make those stories up? I mean, I've heard it before also. That's why I was interested in hearing it.
I understand that Colonel, you know, I didn't hear him say it himself, you know. It comes second-handed for me, or maybe third or fourth-handed, but I understand that Colonel Gale, he was in charge of, you know who I'm talking about, Colonel Gale, don't you?
Oh, yeah, William Gale. I have some of his work on the Wesley Swift site that I sponsor.
He was supposed to have said, he was in the process of repatriating some of those Japanese soldiers after the war was over. And of course, the first thing they do when there's soldiers like that, they make them undress, clear down. You know, they maybe with, you know, allow them to have the shoes on their feet. I don't know if they allow that, but see, they could have a hand grenade or some kind of a weapon, you know, and so that's reason for them to have them undress. And so he would have had occasion to see whether they had stubs or tails. So that's where I get that's what I've heard my stuff from, and so it's I don't really have it documented, but that's where I heard the story from.
Well, I don't doubt it one bit. I mean, I've heard plenty of the stories myself. And I've even seen the occasional story in the news about Asian babies and tails, being born with tails, especially in India and in the Far Eastern Soviet republics, like Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan and those areas.
Well, that kind of brings us to the subject that satire in the Old Testament actually means ape. And Adam Clark, in his commentary, he just couldn't figure it out. And he put a lot of research. He was a man that knew a lot of languages. He knew the Arabic, and I don't know, there may be a lot of people listening that they don't see Hebrew is not a complete language in our Bibles.
Right. There's only about 8,600, I think, or 8,800 Hebrew words used in the Bible. But the Hebrew language had many more words than that, and there are many words that are compound words or derivative words from root words that are never used in the Bible. And that's right. And as an example, I'd like to say that there's only about 5,600 Greek words, 5,700 Greek words used in the Bible, in the New Testament. But the Greek lexicon I have it's got to have 100,000 words in it.
Uh-huh.
My big Liddell and Scott lexicon.
There's a lot of words in there that you won't find in the Bible too, right?
Oh, there's thousands and thousands of words you don't find in the Bible.
Well, anyway, the word that's translated devil in our King James Version, there's two different words that's translated devil, but the main one that's translated devil most of the time is satire. And Adam Clark went to the, like all good Hebrew scholars would do, he went to the Arabic to find a root meaning, and he found that in Arabic, satire is an ape. So that kind of puts a little different complexion on what the devil and Satan, and the word Satan he traced to orangutan. So I wrote pretty extensive. I on part three of identifying the beast of the field, I took 4 pages of Clark's work on that, and I even put the I had to be awful careful on those Arabic fonts because they were all new to me, and I hope I've got them right, but I worked for several hours on there matching up the what he had in the book and the fonts I had on my computer, and I hope I've got those right, but
But let me say that this, you transposed that just fine. That the Hono Kentaurus, where the Greek Septuagint writers saw the Hebrew form of the word Seder. Now, Seder is a Greek word, okay, Saturus. And it's a Greek word that came right from Hebrew. And the Hebrew word has several uses. One of them is the name of the mountain that Esau lived on, and that was Mount Seir, right? And that's that Hebrew form of the word Seder.
I didn't know that that was Mount Seir.
well, yes, and Esau was
me.
And Esau was rough and hairy.
Yeah.
Okay, Esau was rough and hairy, and he lived on basically Mount Seir. It's the same word. Okay? Now that's why I kind of think that Esau's offsprings were considered to be the first satyrs. I might be wrong about that.
So he married some tailless apes, right?
Well, right, but this is what's strange. Now, Saturus is a Greek word, and it's used of the half man, half goat creature that was imagined to be running around the forests and the outlying regions. And I think that's a reference to the other races, that they parodied them. I think that's where we got that from. I can't prove that, but it's my belief from reading all the Greek literature that I've read. Now the Septuagint translators, they saw this Hebrew word, and they did not write the Greek equivalent, Saturus. They wrote this word, Onokantaros. And Liddell and Scott say that the word, and I believe Liddell and Scott, and you have proven this with Pliny, right? With Pliny.
Uh-huh.
That word was, used to describe a tailless ape.
Yeah, Pliny the Elder and Pliny the
right.
Younger.
And Liddell and Scott also, and Liddell and Scott, that they don't cite Pliny, they cite older Greek writers when they define the word as a tailless ape. But let me say that Onokantaurus is a strange word, because an onus is an ass, and a centaur is a centaur. That's a half-man, half-horse creature. So really, I think what the Septuagint is trying to tell us, that these were basically half-assed people. I mean, an onus is a donkey or an ass. It's strange. It's a strange word. But yes, that the Greek writers used it to describe a type of tailless ape, what they imagined to be a tailless ape.
Well, I don't think you could describe a nigger any better than being a tailless ape.
Well, I don't disagree, and perhaps that's what the Hebrews were trying to tell us with the use of the word Seder.
And by the way, I've used that 4 times, either 3 or 4 times. Now, what you sent me out of Liddell and Scott, and I made those corrections on the Greek there on those 3 fonts that I didn't have in there. I've got those in there now. So,
and when Christ tells us that the Adamic world is divided into sheep and goats, And we know who the goats are and who the sheep are. And the goats, you know, he uses that metaphor, goats, of these people that are rejected. And the satyr is depicted by the Greeks as being half human and half goat. And thinking about Esau living on Mount Seir, basically, is what Mount Seir means. It's perfect. It's the metaphors are consistent in throughout Greek and Hebrew culture, right through the Bible.
So, as far as I'm concerned, knowing that when my eyes tell me when I look at a nigger, I'm looking at an ape, and I believe my eyes, and having all this other documentation that I have on this now, especially with Adam Clark's input on this thing, when I'm looking at a black or a nigger, I'm looking at a devil.
Well, I would have to agree, because there's no room for them in the Genesis 1 creation. They are called the beast of the field, but they're never called Chaya. That they're called the beast of the field after the word behemoth, right?
Yeah,
it's the
right.
Hebrew word is behemah, and that is the word from which we acquire the English word behemoth. But that's the word where all of the metaphors are, where beast of the field is clearly used of people, of hominids, that women can lie with and that men can lie with, and hominids that should repent, beasts that should repent. It's always that word behemoth.
Well, I tell you, I kind of hate to compare the animals, you know, the four-footed animals, you know.
We're insulting
the
animals.
We're insulting them.
We're insulting the animals because Yahweh made the animals and they were good.
Yeah.
But he never made the alien, the non-Adamic races. And that's the bottom line. You could look at the word Che, but you can't. And that's what your papers prove. You cannot take that word Che and find the other races in it. Some people treat that like it's a given, well, like that's where they are. But no, it's not a given, because that word is never used of them.
Most of the people that are using that to try to prove that that's a creation of the other races, they don't even know that the word Che is used two times in that verse.
Right. So which one is them, right?
Yeah, what is it, the beast or is it the living thing?
Well, maybe one of them is the Negroes and the other one's the Chinese.
Okay.
I'm just making a jest because it's
well, that's a pretty good one.
it's just ridiculous.
That's the way some people think.
Now, you know, the proof to me is in the New Testament, because Yahshua Christ, he divides all the nations into two groups, right? Sheep and goats. And the goats go on to eternal destruction, and the sheep go to everlasting righteousness. That's Matthew chapter 25.
Uh-huh. You're
so,
right.
So there's basically two races. There's the sheep race, and there's the goat race.
Well, it's like in Hebrews, there's either sons or they're bastards. And there isn't anything in between.
Well, absolutely. Yet you can be a son, as Paul says, or you could be a bastard. Which are you? And we know who the sons are, and we know who the bastards are. The scriptures are clear on that.
So, if
you're not a son, if you're not one of the children of Israel, if you're not an Adamic man, you have to be a bastard.
And if the fallen angels mixed their seed with beast, the result is bastards. It's in the right category.
And every plant which my heavenly Father did not plant shall be rooted up. That's why the sheep go on the right and all the goats go on the left to eternal destruction. There's no getting around that. There's two races of people on the planet. There's sheep and there's goats. There's wheat and there's tares. There's sheep and there's goats. There's sons and there's bastards. Whatever idioms you want to use to explain them, there's only two races on the whole planet in the eyes of God.
You know, if you don't understand the idioms in the Bible, you take everything literally and you have no conception at all what that book is saying. It's really important to learn the idioms.
Now the parable of the net, you quoted that in one of
the right, Matthew 13:47-50.
Now, the kingdom of heaven, now I'm going to pull it up and read it.
Yeah,
I
go ahead and read it, yeah.
I can paraphrase it, but I'll actually quote it instead. And again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a net that was cast into the sea and gathered of every kind, which when it was full, they drew to shore and sat down and gathered the good into vessels, but cast the bad away. So shall it be at the end of the world. The angels shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the just, and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I'm sure a lot of Adamic sheep people are going to be the ones weeping because they're upset that Yahweh took their mixed-race spouse and children away from them.
Well, see, that word kind there is genos in the Greek, and it means race.
Absolutely.
So the gospel is thrown out to the sea of people, you know, and it gets, you know, we sent people to Africa and all over and went a lot of places it shouldn't have. And it drew in a lot of people into the various churches that shouldn't be there. It was never meant for. And that's what we have today. And the net has to be drawn into shore, and the good racial kind will be saved in the vessels, and the bad racial kind will be thrown away.
And that's what this is telling me, is that Yahshua Christ, being Yahweh himself, prophesied universalism. He prophesied the universal church.
Yeah, that is. It's a prophecy that there would be a universal church, and there has to be an end to it.
Right, no doubt. And there will be an end to it. And he will cleanse his household. And kind there is the word genos, and it definitely means race. And it's very notable that the King James translators did not translate it as generation in this verse, because everywhere else it means race. They translated generation practically. Where it actually, in the sense that we know the word generation, it's only used once or twice. And even then, it's an entire race in a certain generation. So it takes on an additional connotation, but it doesn't lose its original meaning ever.
Well, you see, when a fisherman goes, even today, you know, fishermen, they go out, and they come in, and they've got a bunch of fish in the box where they're saving them and everything. When they get to shore, they've got some fish in there they don't want. They don't put them back in the water so somebody else can catch them.
Right. They throw them on a shore. And what happens to fish flopping on a seashore?
Oh, they die.
They just cast them away. They don't even put them back in the water, right?
It would be, that would be considered a very bad thing for a fisherman to do, is to throw a dirty fish, you know, that people don't want to eat. Throw them back in the water for some other fishermen to catch.
well, today you'd be called a criminal for throwing fish on the shore and walking away, and not putting them back in the water. The environmentalists would come after you. They're going to be mad at God too.
Yeah.
They're going to be upset with Yahweh also.
You know, those parables are pretty. I mean, when you figure them out and everything, I mean, They're pretty descriptive.
Well, yeah, I did a program last summer on the parables relating to race, and I walked through all of that.
But I've been meaning to get on the parables, but I've never got around to it.
I should probably resurrect that program and replay it one day. Because almost all the parables of Christ have a racial.
There's so many things to address. You know, you don't know where to start next. But is there any place else in the fourth documents I got so far in that you think's worth citing there? Or?
Well, you had gone to great lengths to show that the Septuagint and the Josephus, neither of those translations, neither of those interpreters of Scripture saw the creation of other races of people in Genesis 1:24.
Yeah, I did. I cited Josephus, and he had a fairly concise. See if I can pull it up here. Paste it in.
Well, it's at the bottom of page 8 of the document that you sent me.
Another witness is at Josephus Antiquities 111, which reads, quote, "On the sixth day he created the four-footed beast and made them male and female. On the same day he also created, he also formed, used the word form man, you know, which a lot of people jump onto that word. I'll go over that again. On the same day he also formed man," unquote. Please notice here that Josephus mentions absolutely nothing concerning God creating the non-white races in Genesis chapter 1.
Well, right. So no matter where you turn, you can't find the non-Adamic races in the Che in the creation of Genesis chapter 1.
I don't think Josephus would have overlooked something like that.
Well, it's just unsubstantiated. If you try to attribute that to the creation of the other races as we know them today, you're taking a stand that's absolutely not substantiated. That's the way I would look at it. I wouldn't rule out totally the possibility of any hominid being created in the beast creation.
Well, I believe that there's people before Adam and Eve.
Well, right, but we don't know what they were like. I think that if there were people before Adam and Eve, they were the fallen angels.
Yeah, I think so too. That's my gut feeling.
We have apes, and we have Cro-Magnons and Neanderthals. And to find one of the other races before that, it is practically impossible. Any of these races here cannot be those original people. They just can't be, because Christ and the apostles divide the world, the inhabitants of the earth, into sheep and goats. There's no third choice.
Well, I think in archaeology they found that the blacks go back around 60,000 years.
Well, right, and the Neanderthals go back further than that.
The Chinese, they say 200,000. Now, that's just guesses, you know, on the part of the archaeologists and stuff, but that's the figures that I remember reading before.
Right, but they are well within the and when they go back a million years, all they find is apes, basically, and monkeys. And until you have the Cro-Magnon and the Neanderthal man, you really don't have Negroes as we know them today. You really don't have the Arab races as we know them today, or any of the other that we can't find them. And I believe that's because they were created by those fallen angels, who may very well have been the ancestors or the Cro-Magnon and or Neanderthal men. And I think that's very plausible. It can't be proven, but that's my belief, that they created the other races. And that's why they themselves disappeared. They outbred themselves by mixing with everything else. Now, today we are in, and I have a letter on this in my email that I still have to answer. We're confronted with genetic findings, and the person that wrote me the letter is here, so I'm glad she's here. we're confronted with genetic findings that some of the people of Europe have Neanderthal DNA in their blood. But whenever these geneticists do these tests, they don't tell us who has it. They don't distinguish that. They'll say 2% of the people in England or 4% of the people in England have this element in their DNA or that element in their DNA. And they never tell us who that 2% or that 4% is.
Well, the wrong people have their hands on the machinery that checks the DNA.
Well, that's true. And I would question any of those studies because they don't properly identify that their subjects. They never properly identify their subjects. And what is an Englishman to me is probably a much narrower definition than what an Englishman is to them. And whenever a study comes out like that, I wouldn't even be concerned with it because I'd want to know who those 4% of the people are or who those 2% of the people are. And I don't, you know, we have 80% of our genes in common with dogs and cats. And that's just the way Yahweh's creation is. It's the genes that they don't have that are important.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's clear that there are certain haplogroups that identify us as people, but I think that we could also tell just as much pretty accurately by looking at a person and know which haplogroup he's most likely going to fall into. So I don't trust the assessments of the DNA studies as they are published in mainstream, especially in the media, because they jump on anything to twist it, and their end goal is to convince all white people that we are already of mixed race. So why just not go mix some more? That's their agenda. Their agenda, the Jewish agenda with DNA evidence, is to try to somehow prove to us that evolution is true and that we're already mixed.
Well, you know, even before that, they knew anything about DNA, they had that book, The Melting Pot, and they was trying to. It was written by Jews, and they were trying to teach us that we were already mixed. You know.
Yes.
That was the idea of the book, The Melting Pot.
Yes.
And,
absolutely. That's been their agenda right from the beginning.
But you know, there one of the definition words of devil and Satan that Adam Clark discovered is the word fornication, and he says, and in one place at least, filthiness or fornication.
Well, that's what they are. That's what they do. They fornicated the creation of God. And that's why they're multiculturalists, and that's why they accuse us of being racists. Because a racist is really love.
Now, fornication's Greeks, right? That's not Hebrew.
Well, I could explain that. And my point was that racism is really love, and it's really the intent on preserving the original creation of God and out of love for God. And the people that want to mix the creation of God and destroy it, they hate God. And that's rebellion from God. Now fornicate, all right, adultery and fornication. This question comes up all the time. In the Hebrew language, the word for adultery means just that, adultery. To adulterate something is to pollute it with a foreign substance. And in the Ten Commandments, the word adultery means thou shalt not race mix. Because the 10th commandment is, do not covet thy neighbor's wife. So, I mean, why would Yahweh issue two commandments that are almost alike? It makes no sense when he's only given us a list of 10. And it's the word adultery is clearly race mixing. It's to commit adultery is... The definition in the Strong's Concordance is vague, but the meaning of the Hebrew related Hebrew words, and the meaning of the commandment is clear, that adultery is race mixing.
Well, evidently, he's got it in italics here, so it evidently in the Hebrew it is translated, you know, in the King James Version it's translated as filthiness, but it would be the same as fornication in the New Testament.
Now the
Ezekiel.
Let me go to the Greek culture. In the Greek culture, the Septuagint writers picked a good word to translate the Hebrew word that means adultery. Oh, okay, that word is naath or naath, and I can't pronounce it right. It's Strong's number 5003. Well, the Hebrew writers, the Septuagint writers, the Hebrew translators into Greek of the scripture in the 4th century B.C., they picked a word with a literal meaning, which means to mix. Megnumi is a verb, which means to mix. And moikos is adultery, and that word means mixed. And where it says, thou shalt not commit adultery, that's the word they chose, okay? And that's a perfect literal translation. But it's not how the Greeks used the word. Because the Greeks used the word in a wider sense. They didn't use it to mean mixing as if your blood was mixing with somebody of a different race. They used it as mixing in the sense of causing confusion within the clan or within the nation or race when you're having sex outside of marriage with people of, yeah, you know, of your own tribe, but with people that aren't your spouse, what you're doing is you're confusing the bloodline. Yeah, you know, like you have three kids and they're from three different fathers and everybody thinks they're from your husband. Yeah, you know what I mean? That's how the Greeks used the word in their culture. So the apostles understood that. And the apostles understood that, so that's why they added the injunction about fornication in Acts chapter 15.
Oh, uh-huh.
And that's why Jude defined fornication as the pursuit of strange flesh. Now, fornication to a Greek, it can mean any sort of illicit sex, but in the Greek mind, one of those sorts of illicit sex is race mixing. In other words, sex with a goat is fornication, and sex with a two-legged goat is fornication too. Yet, you know, it's considered fornication to the Greeks to have sex with somebody else outside of your own tribe or race. So the apostles understood this, and Paul uses that word to describe a race-mixing event in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, where he talks about 24,000 being killed in one day in a judgment by Yahweh upon Israel because the Israelites joined them, the men joined themselves to the daughters of Moab. And that's clearly, that's Numbers chapters 23, 24, 25, 26, that's clearly a race-mixing event, and Paul uses that word fornication, pornēs, to describe it. So while the Greeks used pornēs to describe any form of illicit sex, race-mixing was one of them. And when you mentioned that word, that would have been the thought in the minds of the people, that would have been included. So that's why they added the injunction concerning fornication in Acts chapter 15 to clarify that commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. That's the only logical explanation.
It's kind of odd the way he puts it here. You know, he has this opus, you know, as it in Greek, opus are likely to mean at once a snake, a crocodile, hippopotamus. Fornication, a chain, a pair of fetters, a piece of brass, a piece of steel,
Well, right. He did well there with all of the ways that serpent is used in the Bible. But, you know, he kind of disappointed me with the Leviathan of Isaiah 27:1, where he says that it means a crocodile or an alligator.
Oh, yeah, I remember what he said there, yeah.
The Leviathan, and he's under that same spell of blindness that Yahweh imposed on all of Israel, there's no doubt. But where Isaiah 27:1 says, in that day Yahweh with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, the crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. Now that does not mean a literal sea monster. Because
there's
no crocodile or alligator that has to be punished for the sins of the children of Israel.
You have to be careful how you use these commentaries. But I like Adam Clark above the rest of them, because he understood several languages, and some of his comments I just brush aside, but when he's talking about the meaning of a certain word or something, I listen to it, you know, I read and see what he says about it, because he seems to be pretty good on the language.
Well, right, but he didn't have quite all the metaphors down, and the Leviathan in Isaiah 27:1 is the children of the serpent. It's a metaphor for the Jew and the other Canaanite races that are among us. The sea is the mass of people, and the serpent in the sea is the rebellious race, the children of the devil.
And what do you think about this guy over there in Ireland now that's kind of taken the same position as Ted R. Weiland? His name's McFarland, right? Ken McFarland?
Well, right. Well, the British Israel people are, it's obvious to me that they are starting to feel embattled. They're getting it from the two seed liners. They're getting it from the mainstream. Their theology cannot stand. And that's what happens when you are lukewarm, you end up in trouble. And you end up dodging to explain yourself. That's exactly what happens.
Oh, by the way, I was able to open that document up all right, so I got it on my computer.
Okay. Yeah, he, I'll let you address it, and then when I see your address, you know, if I have anything to add, I'll contribute.
Mm-hmm.
But he finds himself having to deny two seed line and defend himself against two seed line. Well, I was sent by somebody in Britain. I was sent a picture today of this British Israel World Federation, and they took the flag of Northern Ireland, and they superimposed the Star of David onto it, and they're performing a ceremony with this flag that they have. The British Israel World Federation has absolutely
that's blasphemous.
That's absolutely blasphemous. That's the star of their god, Rapha. That's absolutely a blasphemy, and they're basically, the British Israel World Federation is worshiping the devil. That there's no doubt. There's no other explanation for it. It's absolutely blasphemy.
I thought I'd mention it because maybe some of the others that's listening to the talk show, maybe they aren't familiar with that particular document. Maybe you ought to give them a link that they can go to so they can read it for themselves.
Well, I only have the document in the email. It'll be posted somewhere.
I'm
going to wait until we have a rebuttal to it.
It needs to be addressed.
The British Israel World Federation is in bed with Ted Wieland and Yair Davidi to refute two seed line, and they're desperate and groping for straws. But that's okay. It's good to keep them on the defensive.
But see, without two seed line, you can't even understand what we're talking about here tonight.
Without two seed line, you can't understand history. You might claim to, but you don't know a damn thing. I'm sorry, you can't understand anything that's happened the last, especially since the French Revolution. You have no understanding without two seed line. That's the foundation stone of the fall of Adam. That's the way it is. That's the foundation stone of the fall of Adam.
Yeah.
That's the what caused it all.
It's the foundation by a verse. You know, the whole Bible is based on Genesis 3:15.
Well, right. That's the reason for it. The reason for the turmoil in this life is caused. It is found in Genesis chapter 3, and is summed up in Genesis 3:15. And when we embrace the enemies of Yahweh, we're embracing the seed of the serpent. And we're in bed with the devil.
I should mention also that people that don't have it, they should get a hold of a copy of it. It's a little expensive. I think I paid maybe $45 14 years ago for it. Gesenius Hebrew Chaldee Lexicon of the Old Testament. And if you just have Strong sometimes give you a paragraph or two, or Gesenius sometimes will give you a couple, three pages on a word. And another thing you'll find in the Gesenius, they get into the other languages of the Old Testament. And they show the alphabets of the ancient Hebrew, which is before the present Hebrew that we understand. They have an Arabic alphabet. They have a Syriac alphabet. They get into, you know, they get into several, you know, Greek and Coptic and Armenian and that. And in their definitions, they've got these tables of alphabets and a comparative table of ancient alphabets in the front of the book. And then throughout there, they're citing different Arabic and different Syriac and various It's a study aid that'll go beyond Strong's, and if a person is really a serious student, they should get a copy of Gesenius Hebrew Chaldee Lexicon of the Old. It's printed by Baker, and of course I know that we're supporting the wrong people when we buy this stuff, but.
But where else do we get it from?
Yeah, where else do we get it? Yeah. So if a person doesn't have that and they want a little more insight than what you'll get from Strong's, Gesenius would be a good tool to do that. And a Brown Driver's Brig wouldn't be bad either, you know. That's really, it's Brown Driver's Brig Gesenius. But there's things in there that Gesenius doesn't have yet, you know, in the one that I just cited here. But we need these things. Sometimes I get on a roll, and the first thing I know, I'm looking in my books and going to the computer, and it's amazing. Got a lot of electronic data.
Yeah, I would love to get an electronic copy of Gesenius that was accurate. I don't know.
I don't know. I doubt whether it's.
I'm sure that would be a real challenge getting all those fonts and everything into a program that was shareable.
They'll probably have it somewhere along the line, but you know, you paid $300 or $400 to get a copy of it, probably.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt it. They get you coming and going, the software companies. I can't imagine how much they want. I would rather sell 100 copies of a program for $10 than sell 5 copies for $100.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't seem to it doesn't seem to bother them. I mean, Bible Works and Logos and that they have a lot of garbage in them. They have some pretty good tools. And they're good resources for that reason. It's easy to do searches and to find things and to compile information and to evaluate it. But they want $1,500, $2,000 for some of those programs. It's crazy for one copy. And that's just mad. So I'll spend it $30 or $40 or whatever it is in order my Gesenius front the old fashioned way, right? From a bookstore.
It's nice that you got your book ready to go.
Well yeah, it's the cover art is just a little off center and that was a confusion with Lulu that I had, but I'm not worried about it. I don't think it really damages the book. It's gonna go the way it is. I'm not gonna hold it up any longer. And the Christogenean New Testament is on available on my website right now.
Mm-hmm. But you say that in the book that you have now, the notes are not there. It's just a translation, right?
Right. When I do the notes, it's going to be four separate volumes, and two of them are just about ready, right?
Have you done any work on the notes in and the ones you hadn't finished there, that was
no, good. I haven't. They've been sitting in notepads for the last 15
Matthew,
months.
Matthew and Revelation and that.
Right. I got 24 notepads, I think it is. 12 for John and 12 for Matthew and Mark, and they're all sitting across the room in the bottom.
Oh, you've got it in rough form, right?
Yes, but I have to type them all, and that's a huge task, and edit them rewrite a lot of them. But and double check them all. There's a lot of work that has to be done, and if I get it done in the next 5 years, I'll be happy.
So, well, maybe David would still do some typing for you.
Well, right, but I mean, I could type. It's just getting the time away from the programs and the technology issues and all the other things I do. They pretty much fill a week up.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of time.
That was nice of David to do all that typing when you were in prison. And
well, right. If you look inside the cover of the Christogenean New Testament, you'll see typeset and edited by David and Nadia Gray. David Gray and his wife did a lot of work for me, and they also typeset and edited my Luke book and my Paul books. But now I have to change all the fonts so that I can
Yeah, so it'll work with the printer.
Right, so it'll work with the publisher, because they used old Greek fonts from like WordPerfect 95 or something.
Well, the same ones I'm using still.
Well, yeah, and they don't work on the internet, and they don't work with the printer.
I'll get changed over one of these days and get some stuff on the newer computer. But see, my real good printer is still on Windows 98. So, and I'm operating on talk show here on Windows 98. So I'm really old fashioned, behind times.
Yeah, well, we got to get you up to date sooner or later, so that I can catch a break changing these stupid fonts. it's a lot of tedious work. Okay, I'm going to cut the program. I mean, it was enjoyable talking to you, Clifton, and thank you. And this is William Fink for Eli James, and this is Yahweh's Covenant People. And praise Yahweh, and good night all. Thank you.